Homicides in Jacksonville are now on pace to top last year's numbers. Tenants wonder where they'll go as the city takes possession of the Jacksonville Landing. And the Florida legislature gets ready to wind down this weekend. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. They are in studio and ready to go, and you can join them right now. Call us up. It's 549-2937. Then later, why the Florida Theater is going totally 80s this month. We'll tell you about 80s on Forsyth. That should be a lot of fun. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome Stephanie Brown of WOKV. Good morning.
Good morning.
David Bauerline of the Florida Times-Union is here.
Good morning, everyone.
Shelton Hall of Folio Weekly back with us.
Good morning.
And our regular contributor, blogger Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you all here, guys, and lots to talk about this Friday. Everything from last-minute moves in Tallahassee to the fate of those tenants at the Jacksonville Landing and more. But our top story this Friday, Jacksonville clocked 52 homicides in the first 4 months of 2019. That is the most in 13 years. Why does this number remain so tragically high? Why can't Jacksonville find a way to stem the tide of gun violence? We want to talk about this first off on the roundtable this morning with your calls at 549-2937. Give us a call. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And David Bauerline, let's begin with you. It's not as though the city isn't still trying very hard to do something about this. They've brought in a group called Cure Violence to begin work on a program that will reduce gun deaths. It's seen some success in other cities. They're not spending a ton of money on it, given how deep and enduring a problem this is. You know, we've covered this through multiple mayoral administrations over a period of many years, and it's simply not going away.
It's not. And there is a group that's meeting that was put together by the city council president, Aaron Bowman, that's going to come up with some recommendations as well. You know, the big picture is a lot of this crime is from neighborhoods that have lag behind the rest of the city in terms of the economic conditions in them. And so that's a big, heavy lift that would take a long time to fix.
You know, I read a column the other day by your colleague, Nate Monroe, and he traced some of these issues to the 50 years of consolidation in the city of Jacksonville. And let me ask you all about that. Given that we are a consolidated city-county government, the argument he made is that it's hard to get people in leafy suburbs to care about homicides and gun violence deaths in neighborhoods that are far away from where they live and where they don't have an understanding of the issues and they don't relate to the people in those neighborhoods. What about that argument? Shelton Hall.
Well, there's a little substance to that argument, certainly. But I think in these so-called leafy neighborhoods, they're not as leafy as they used to be. And what we're seeing with this expansion of violence in the community is that it's starting to reach out to places that were normally considered kind of immune from the violence. We had a murder-suicide just the other day in Sanssouci. We're having more incidents of people getting robbed and stuff coming out of malls, coming out of bars and clubs. And I think a big part of the problem is that we think of this community as being divided and isolated because of demographics, because of geography, when in fact it's all one city. And the crime is not limited to geography at all.
Stephanie Brown, when you look at the numbers around homicides, that's true. You know, this is an issue for all of Duval County.
What's interesting in some of the recent approaches that have been taken is it's targeted toward activating the communities where this violence is taking place. So there's no question that mobilizing the entire county and getting everybody to realize that action is needed is important. But what we're really seeing in the last few months, I would say, is a focus really on looking at the communities where violence is most notorious, is taking place at the highest levels, and trying to spark the action there and in those specific communities. So we're going to have to see if we can get that kind of, it's almost not attention, but action. The people willing to participate there to try to bring about some of the change.
It's 549-2937. Crime is going down in most cities across America, but in a few cities, it's going up, including here in Jacksonville, where violent crime remains stubbornly high. Fred Matthews, you know, it's... how many times have we been on this show and talked about this issue? And, you know, under the current administration, although they've made moves to combat this with Cure Violence and other initiatives, we're not seeing any progress, not yet anyway, although we hope to see some.
One of the interesting things pointed out in the column that we all seem to have read this week in the Times Union is that the campaign is over, and thus the people who would lead us into the promised land of no homicides and less murders are no longer on the trail. And the overtime that the sheriff was using before the campaign all of a sudden doesn't seem to be as important as it was a few weeks ago. And that's simply where we are. And one of the hardest things for politicians to do is to tell people the truth about the murder rate and the homicide and what's causing it and what can be done. And the fact of the matter is the sheriff can't do anything about the murder rate. He certainly can't do anything about the homicide rate because he doesn't have a pre-crime computer. And the mayor can't do very much more about it other than what he did, bring in this group to handle one section of town from another city that has a worse gang problem than we ever have, and they haven't solved it yet.
But let me ask you about that. You know, a few mayors ago, under the Peyton administration, there was this massive citywide effort that involved taxpayer funding and had a whole array of interlocking programs to bring down the murder rate.
But they stopped.
That's what I'm saying. So it's not as though that something couldn't be done. It's that something isn't being done in terms of that massive, citywide, comprehensive, long-term effort looking at prevention, intervention, and then also enforcement. Stephanie Brown, there is no dedicated funding source to an initiative like the former Jacksonville Journey.
So there may not be the Journey funding, but there are programs that have been put in place that maybe just aren't getting a spotlight as much. We've talked a lot about Cure Violence, which is the most recent, but what we've seen from this administration is a push toward technology, especially. We have ShotSpotter, real-time crime centers, surveillance cameras, not arguing that this is a comprehensive fix. You know, the technology network only stretches so far and is invested in some of the more high crime areas at a, you know, a more proportional rate. But those are, you know, things that they're trying to let take hold and see if some time will move toward that. And we've talked about, you know, that three-pronged stool, the prevention, intervention, enforcement. We know they've been working on putting more police on the street. We know they've been trying to invest in those community initiatives. So while it may not be a Journey mm-hmm. plan by the strict definition, it may not have the dedicated funding source, I think you are seeing some pieces trying to be put together from each of those different legs, so to speak.
But they've got to have the buy-in, and they've got to have the education piece from the community. Look, at the root of the majority of crimes that we're concerned about, murders that we're concerned about, is the same thing. Poverty, under education, and lack of services. Unless the city of Jacksonville, and that's what people are saying, that's what the North Side Coalition has been railing about for these last few years, that's what people have talked about over and over again. Unless the city of Jacksonville is willing to undertake a Marshall Plan to help in those areas, then we're going to continue to see the same numbers that we have. One of the things that they did in Atlanta that was always interesting when Mayor Jackson got to be mayor there in Atlanta many, many years ago was that he had some basic economic dictates that he put out. The airport would have a set-aside where X amount of people would have to be employed there, contracts would have to be let there to minorities so that they can get in on the economic viability of that area. We're not willing to have that kind of Marshall Plan here because fundamentally, our politicians who lead the city don't believe in set-asides. They don't believe that it's worth their time to go over in zip codes 7, 8, and 9 and do the work that has to be done. You can't continue to say, oh, it's unfortunate they only have three grocery stores and nobody does anything with it. You can't continue to say that. You can't continue to look at the housing complexes there that can have a ever revolving cycle of unemployment and no jobs for these people to go to and say, hey, we're going to cut their food stamps and make them work. Where are they going to work at? Where's the jobs? Family Dollar can only employ so many people. And that's what we're talking about here. That lowers the numbers. Economics, that lowers the numbers. We're not willing to face that. And we're not willing. We don't have a leader who's willing to do that kind of work in this city.
Shelton.
Well, Fred's absolutely right. We're not making an effort to get jobs for these young people, but these young people are finding jobs. Business is booming on that end, and that's why the murder rate is so high. We've had all these efforts to, you know, Jacksonville Journey, Cure Violence, all this going back the last 15, 20 years. And with all of our efforts, at best, we might shave the murder rate down 10%, maybe 20% for a couple of years, but then it boosts right back up. I find it very telling that this year, with this election that just ended, the whole point of the election was politicians demagoguing the crime issue against each other. And everyone knew that crime was the biggest issue. And then we had a 24% turnout, no real opposition against the mayor. And then lo and behold, the numbers are up and everyone acts surprised.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more the city could do on the prevention side. The whole idea of the Jacksonville Journey, it was a first year installment and then the amount was supposed to keep going up. So it didn't go up. It certainly adjusted for inflation. It's not gone up. So there's a tremendous amount more that can be done on the prevention side to reach more young people. Some of the economic things, those are long-term things. I mean, you can do all the, put a Marshall Plan together, but that doesn't mean the crime rate's going to be down next year.
It takes a lot of time. It becomes very difficult
to muster the kind of political will that says, okay, we've got a 5-year, 10-year plan, and it's going to have to be investment year after year. And, you know, okay, and your taxes are going to go up as well to pay for it.
Right. It's hard to get politicians to push a plan like that when they're thinking of the next election and they have shorter windows of time that they're looking at, when what this does require, as you said, David, is a long-term citywide commitment. And it's been talked about and talked about, but we haven't seen it yet. But we do have a lot of calls about this. It's 549-2937 here to join us Friday on the roundtable. Linda is on the south side right now. Hi, Linda. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, I think part of it is we have a CEO of the city. We have a CEO of the police department. And we just had an election where we didn't ask them to put out a plan. So we don't have a plan. I have no idea what the plan was, except Mayor Curry said, the sheriff said he needed more bodies. He gave them the officers he needed. And the sheriff is the sheriff. If he doesn't know what to do, he needs to find out, because people have been dying on his watch and we didn't ask him what he was going to do. Shot spotter is after the fact. So what is your plan, sir? They've shown that they don't need to care, because 24% of the people turned out and they consider this a mandate. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about that? Stephanie Brown.
It's, again, there's so many different components to this. So yes, the numbers that we're seeing are difficult, but as you mentioned just a short time ago, it takes time for some of these initiatives. So do you trace this to what's being done this year, last year, the year before? How long do you allow to say that any progress is being done? So there are, again, pieces that are being put out. There are pieces that should still be done. But as you said, you know, kind of getting that, you know, she mentioned it as a mandate, so to speak. It's just so difficult to say, you know, is that a result of the what's being done right now? Is it the work that's being done? Or is it just that we know the mayor's race didn't have a lot of competition, that, you know, that was really going to drive it. The sheriff didn't have a real strong opposition. So it was really a sense of not having that competition in those races that maybe drove some of the apathy as well.
CJ is in San Marco. Hello, CJ. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really important conversation. I mean, we're talking about life and death here. What we have here is basically a confluence of so many factors of history of the choices that we've made. First, we're living with the effects of redlining, where you had government that was dictating where African Americans could live and whites were even forbidden from selling to African Americans, and real estate professionals were directing. So you have that. And then you also have the effects on the war on drugs. You had mentioned before that a lot of this is economically based, and when you have government overreach and going after people, predominantly people of color, for drug crimes, low-level drug crimes, you have mistrust, and you have a sort of an us versus them. The police, they're going, and it's, you know, they're doing the best they can, but they're dealt a not a good hand, and the police need to have more community policing to be more of a, not an adversary, but more of a partner to try to regain the trust. But then you're also dealing with economic inequality, and that goes back to redlining, but that also goes back mm-hmm. to just the way our economy is. So there's so many things at play, but we just need to try to come together and try to rebuild our cities. One solution I recommend is something called universal basic income. I'm sure you've talked about it before.
We have talked about that. Mainly, yep. You've heard about it on NPR, our national show, CJ, right. Where some municipalities in some European countries are tinkering with that, particularly as they envision more robotics and automation, making some jobs obsolete in the coming decades. But you made a lot of good points, so I appreciate all of your thoughts. That's CJ in San Marcos. Shelton Hull, let me just point out, too, that when we talk about the murder rate in Jacksonville, we appreciate your insights as a columnist, but also you have you had a personal tragedy in your life that some people know about over a decade ago. You lost someone close to you due to homicide as well.
Yeah, I did. That was it's very unfortunate. She wasn't the first loved one I've lost to violence, wasn't the last one loved one I've lost to violence, and I'm sure the same is true for a lot of us in the listening audience. The guy that killed her was a 17-year-old, a juvenile offender that had escaped from some facility. They tried the midnight basketball and the art therapy and the hand-holding and the back rubs and all the other stuff they're trying to do. And he went on the lam for a month before he killed her. They ran him up. They put him in prison. They didn't really do anything about, you know, the other people that may or may not have been involved in his gang, that may or may not have participated in it. And who knows how many dozens of killings have happened since then as a result of that. Another factor I would point out with this crime thing is you look at, they say it's isolated to certain neighborhoods, certain parts of town. Well, if you look at the city council people who are overseeing those parts of town, this mayor has spent his entire term, you know, love him or hate him, effectively disenfranchising those city council people. The people in those neighborhoods know that their city council people don't have any real power, no real ability to affect change, and no real like grasp on the ear of City Hall. So those people don't have any authority, and the people in those communities feel that they have no real leadership, no real representation. So the streets are rising up to fix that, you know, to kind of fix that, not fix it, but to take that sort of leadership role in a sense. And yeah, you know, I like the Cure Violence program. I respect what they're doing in Philadelphia, but you know, the fact is, it's been over 20 years ago that the Fresh Prince was run all the way out to Bel Air because of the violence in Philly. He never came back.
And never wanted to.
No.
And never wanted to. I mean, look, you know, that's what we are. I mean, unless we are willing to get into the dirt on these issues, mm-hmm. it's going to continue. It is not the job of the police to prevent crimes. Police investigate and arrest. If we can have a DARE program that works, all well and good. If PAL works for X amount of kids, that's extracurricular, and it works. But that's not their job. It is the job, however, of those elected persons who handle legislation and who run the city services to serve those communities. It is their job to dig in and find some solutions to this. And if they're not willing to do it, because of politics. Those people, oh, they're mostly Democrats. So why should we? They're going to vote Democrats. They're going to vote against me. They're going to do that. Look what Anna Broche ended up with in her mayoral run. She got that little pocket of districts eight, council districts 8 and 9. That's what she got. Everybody else voted against her. Now we're looking at Terrence Freeman, who decided to jump out of District 10, which she was appointed to, and run at large against who? A Democrat, who happened to be the former chairman. And he's got better commercials on the air than she does.
So you think political partisanship is part of this issue?
There's no
as
question.
Well.
There's no question about that, because what Shelton just mentioned is that those people who represent those areas are Democrats. They don't have any power. They've all been kicked off of finance and the equivalent of the Ways and Means Committee. They've all been put out in the pasture. The guy who made the most noise represents a small little district over there that's barely surviving. If it wasn't for Edward Waters College and the Newtown zone that they've done over there prior to him getting elected, he wouldn't have very much else to root about.
Well, that gets back to the point that came up earlier in the hour, which is that when the city consolidated 50 years ago, it may not have been the first intention of consolidators, but it had the impact of diluting African-American political power in the core city. Because we have such a huge, far-flung, spread-out city that encompasses the whole county, David, unlike a lot of other cities our size or larger, African-Americans in the core city do not have political power that they have in other cities, like Atlanta or Charlotte or many other cities you could name.
It's a double-edged sword. Obviously, there was a lot of dilution of political power. On the other hand, you have access to a much larger tax base. The question is there a consensus to take advantage of that larger tax base to shift a larger amount of resources into neighborhoods that have been left behind, not just for years, but for decades? And I don't want to be too cynical on this. Let's see what happens with this group of people
with
that's been put together
violence.
By the Pure Violence. And also the council president put together a group. It's got, I think, 40 or 50 people. They're not politicians. They come from a cross-section of the community. It's a racially mixed group. They're not beholden to anybody in terms of their recommendations. Let's see, first of all, what their recommendations are, how ambitious they are. And then let's find out if the political leadership takes them or just puts it on a shelf.
We'll have to see. Lots of people still waiting on hold to talk about violence and cure violence in Jacksonville with our Friday Media Roundtable. Stephanie Brown, David Bauerlein, Shelton Hull, and Fred Matthews all here in studio this morning. But there's some other news we want to get to from the week, so we're going to shift gears now and take your calls on another hot topic. Also making headlines over the week, the city of Jacksonville took control of the Jacksonville Landing a few days ago. This was amid some last-ditch efforts by some activists to try and save it from the wrecking ball. That included City Councilman Matt Carlucci, who called for a charrette or public workshops on the topic. At the same time, tenants at the Landing who have been sent notices terminating their leases are wondering where they'll go next. The bottom line, demolition for the Landing is likely imminent. WJCT did speak earlier this week with Lenny Curry's chief of staff, Brian Hughes. He's also the interim head of the Downtown Investment Authority. He provided us with renderings from 2015 that were the product of a visioning exercise for the Landing under former Mayor Alvin Brown, and said that from the city's point of view, the time for discussion about the Landing's future is over. And so, barring some massive last-minute uprising on the part of citizens that causes a pause, the Landing is almost certainly going to come down. Stephanie Brown, at the same time, some of the tenants are, trying to figure out where they're going to go next.
So we know that most of them got a 30-day notice, and most of them were on month-to-month leases already. And it was widely known as part of the discussion and city council vote that took place that demolition was the goal and that the city would move to terminate those leases once they did take ownership. I will point out there are a few that have some extra time. For example, we got the termination letter for Hooters, and they get more time per their lease. One interesting point, and this is going to affect the timeline for demolition, is Compass Bank actually has through February 2021 on their current lease. And I asked the administration if they are confident they're going to be able to terminate that early. And they basically say right now it's a legal matter, so they're not speaking about it. There is money set aside for buyouts. Hooters, Finn McCool's, for example, per their leases, they're getting buyouts in order to meet that termination. So it's likely, if not possible, that Compass Bank will be as part of a deal and agree to close up shop early. But I will point that out as just something interesting as we look to the timeline for demolition that could become kind of an asterisk until we get some resolution.
Okay. At the same time, WJCT also spoke with the original architect of the Jacksonville Landing back in the 1980s. His name is Hans Strauch. And what he told us on Tuesday was his read of the situation for this site is, quote, the plan is there is no plan.
Yeah.
He went on to say, tearing the building down now with no viable design and economic plan for its replacement is not the answer. And so that's, I think, why we're seeing pushback to this, this perception among voters that there isn't a plan already in place for what to do with the site beyond tearing it down and maybe putting up some green space. Meanwhile, the mayor tweeted this last night. Lenny Curry tweeted out, self-proclaimed pundits on Duval opining on our plan for the landing either have a strategic play or they are lazy Twitter tough guys. I think it is the latter. Yeah. I think it is the latter, given what I've seen the last 4 years. Keep fighting the lazy fight and waging war on social media. I'm a keep winning for the people. So that's the mayor on Twitter.
So there is a plan. We just haven't been told what it is yet. There is a plan, folks. I mean, we didn't do this. He didn't do it without having a plan for this. There is a plan. We just haven't been told what it is yet. The DIA apparently doesn't know yet. And the folks who are asking for a greenscape don't know yet.
Yeah.
The aquarium folks don't know yet. But the mayor apparently does have a plan. And I'm sure he'll reveal it to us
in time. And they have released renderings that include mainly green space. I mean, with some unidentified structures around the edges, and we don't know what those would be yet. But they have released that to the public and the media.
The planning concept is largely green space and a few structures that would be used for various development opportunities. They've been pretty consistent on that. More details not yet available, but I think the interesting point that I guess was brought up by many council members throughout this debate was for the people who say they don't want to see demolition at this point because maybe there's no firm plan on paper. The council members countered, whatever the plan will be, we don't see it involving this structure. You know, there are people who obviously wanted to preserve that building and potentially flip it around for use, but we also know that maintenance was a concern, security was a concern. So by their assessment, whatever that future plan was going to be, it wasn't going to involve this structure either way.
Yeah. Shelton.
Speaking as a self-proclaimed pundit, let me push back. I'm going to push back on the mayor just a little bit. Love him though I do. Frankly, there's 52 people laying in boxes right now that would question how we define winning in this community. And certainly some of the, we say that some of the tenants at the landing are wondering where they're going to go next. But the reality is that a lot of them aren't going anywhere. A lot of the business owners there have had such a terrible time, such a terrible experience, one dealing with Slayman, and two, through this process with the landing coming down, that it's unclear if they're going to go anywhere else. Rent is too high in parts of the landing, and where are they?
But they're still getting a better rent at the landing than they would in other parts of downtown.
Oh, exactly. Right. And fun fact: when the landing was originally built by Rouse in '87, it cost $39.5 million to build. Slayman bought it for $5.1 million and then sold it for $15 million. So we've taken this situation and immediately managed to make it into something that's embarrassing for the city. We'll be talking about plans for the landing, you know, for the next year or two easily. And they don't have a plan. And I don't know. It's a lot like the crime thing. Everyone has ideas. Everyone says they're going to do something. But based on what we've seen so far, I think it's fair to assume that nothing is actually going to be done.
Shelton, the mayor has a plan. He would not do this without a plan. He wouldn't pay out 18. He's a CTBA for crying out loud.
I trust him entirely.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Whether it's the Resiliency Committee or the landing redevelopment, the city seems to have a very narrow and limited role for public participation in major decisions. It's anti-democratic. Okay. That said, the majority of the city council voted to approve demolishing the Jacksonville Landing. The one vocal opponent to this is new incoming city at-large councilman Matt Carlucci, a very well-liked figure, and he has publicly kind of put a stake in the ground opposing this move, saying there's too much outcry, there's too much of a groundswell of opposition to just go forward with demolishing.
I will add one more as well. When the vote took place, there was actually a move by Councilman Danny Becton to try to put those demolition dollars below the line. Basically, the contention was there was a $15 million settlement to take over ownership, $1.5 million to buy out the tenants, $1.5 million for demolition. You had Councilman Danny Becton say, why do we have to do the $1.5 million for demo right now? Can we put it to the side, say we'll lockbox it, access it in the future when there is something more firm in place? So obviously that measure did not work. But I do want to point out that there was some debate and discussion ahead of that final overall approval.
Let me ask, go ahead, David.
I was just going to pick up on what you were saying, Melissa, just on the public participation. You know, Matt Carlucci brought up this idea of a charrette, which immediately is not a good thing because it sounds French. Yeah. but look, the idea is that there is a group of people who are going to make a decision on what the future of the landing would be. And I do think that there will be demolition and there will be something in its place. It's just a question of who's that group going to be? Who is going to be in there with the mayor's ear, giving them ideas, brainstorming it? Who is going to be at that table? And Matt Carlucci was basically just saying,
yeah,
bring the public
to the table.
And another,
let me just jump in and also pose this to the group. And we've brought this up on this program before, that there is a growing perception that the reason that players involved in all of this want the landing site turned into green space is so that Jaguars owner Shad Khan can develop the former site of Metropolitan Park, which is designated as green space. You can't develop on it. But if the city can execute some kind of a land swap, shift the green space over to the former landing site, then the path would ostensibly be cleared to develop on the site of this park land, which used to have the band shell for concerts and so forth. What about that idea?
Well, that's not a bad idea. I mean, we could consider even giving Khan the space himself. A question I've always had about this process is when the city is reaching out to new business people who might want to buy the space or might want to develop it, who's going to come in here from outside and take this space over, given the history that the previous owners or tenants have had with the city? Slayman took over in 2003, I believe, and he had all these plans wanting to cut out the center part of it so you could see the water from all the way down Laura Street, wanting to put in new parking, and the city never... The city never backed him up. The city had a very adversarial relationship with him for 15 years, and then they ended up paying him triple what he originally paid for the space.
I do think one of the interesting points will be if this is sold to a private developer, if the entire package is sold. One of the reasons there was contention is because the city owned the land, Slayman owned the building, so he could not do anything without the city signing on. If you have an opportunity to sell the property outright, that changes that relationship dynamic, but also, again, assumes that the city wants to get rid of its ownership stake. So I think that'll be an interesting question.
Whoever buys the place next, I'm pretty sure that whoever wants to take it over next, part of that deal will specify that the city has nothing to do with that space going forward. The city's meddling in the landing space over the last 15, 20 years is exactly why we're in this position right now.
It's 549-2937 to join the Friday Media Roundtable. What are your thoughts? Bobby on the north side. Hello, Bobby. Good morning.
How y'all doing today?
All right, thanks.
I'm shocked that y'all are doubting the wisdom of Jared Kushner Hughes. You know, he's the mayor's go-to guy. He's the smartest guy in the room. Just ask him. He'll be glad to tell you. you know.
All right, a little sarcasm out there from some listeners.
He's not even in the room, and he's the smartest.
But Bobby, in all seriousness, what would you like to see happen with the space? Because it does look as though I doubt there will be anything to stop the steamroll here of demolishing the structure.
Build it, and they will come. You know, let's build something. You know, all we're doing is tearing things down lately, and be nice to see might have a plan to actually build something around here for a change.
All right. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks, Bobby. And he gets at, I think, why the city is perhaps getting defensive about this, pushing back, because there's this groundswell of there's been too much demolition in the urban core without a plan for what's going to go in the place of these buildings that are coming down. And are we looking at the prospect of more empty lots in the city for years and years to come if there isn't something set up already for what will go in their place? I think that's what he's getting at.
I think that's true. And I do think, again, I agree with Fred, there will be a plan. There will be a concept put forward. I don't think that, I think that is the piece of property the city has the most control over to put its, for the Curry administration, put its mark on downtown development. So I think that will happen. And the big question is, you have a certain area of land there. How much of that land proportionally is going to be open space, it's open to the public? How much of it is going to be set aside for private developers where essentially you got to pay to live there or rent space there for an office or go in and eat a dinner there? That's the big debate that's going on, I think.
And the governments don't build private buildings. Private people build private buildings. We're already having enough difficulty with the Berkman 2 issue that we, you know, some of us kind of felt it was never going to go through for one reason or another, and they gave us an excuse. But the city of Jacksonville is not going to let go of their land rights for that, which is sitting on water anyway, by the way, like everything else down there. It's sitting on top of water on stilts that we put there. It's created by us. So the city is never going to let go of their land, right? So whoever, if there were to be a developer out there who would want to put something there, they go into that with their eyes open, understanding that there'll only be tenants. Yeah. And for that reason alone, it's landlocked. It's not a good place to go. You still got the same parking problems that anybody else has. For those reasons, we will probably see a green space there in a swap, much like what we've talked about here, that will help out Mr. Khan on the other end of Bay Street, of Gator Bowl, or we should rename that the Jaguars Boulevard.
Yeah.
That we're going to rename. That's what we're going to look at there. The only problem, the only people that have to be concerned about is folks here at Channel 7, because you're going to be locked in.
Well, I'll tell you, we are watching the development of these plans closely. That's all I'm going to say about that. Bowen is in San Marco. Hey, Bowen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm kind of a new resident to Jacksonville. I've been here for a couple of years. I'm certainly not smart enough to figure out a plan for the landing or who owns what or anything, but it all seems to me, from the outside looking in, sort of like a non-starter until crime is figured out. And, you know, we can do green space and all these great things at the landing, but it's still, nobody wants to go down there until they feel safe. And so my question or comment is, have the city planners thought about bringing down one of the college campuses? I don't even, I guess UNF and Florida State College and having a downtown campus.
And they, in fact, all of the major schools are working on that, increasing their presence in downtown Jacksonville, Bowen, FSCJ, JU, and UNF. So I appreciate you bringing that up. That is happening, actually. And thank you for that call, Bowen. Now, he gets at the perception that downtown and the area around the landing is unsafe. When you look at the statistics, it's not unsafe. Downtown doesn't have a higher crime rate than other parts of town. But for a lot of folks in this community, they hold that inaccurate perception because there have been a few high-profile, horrible incidents that have garnered a lot of attention. And, you know, statistically, you are not unsafe when you are downtown. But what about that whole piece of this?
Well, you're right about the statistics. Perception is a different thing. So the argument that I've heard in the past about why you need something other than just green space where the landing is right now is that it's surrounded by office towers. Those empty out. So then if you are interested in going to what is now the landing site, and if it's just a park in the evening, you're basically going to be going out there without any other built-in activity there, other than people deciding, hey, let's go down to the park and hang out on the riverfront. Mm-hmm. The reality is, this is just the reality, open spaces like that attract homeless people. And so then it becomes a perception issue. Do people coming in from the suburbs or even who live in downtown feel comfortable going down to the park, hanging out there, if they're going to be panhandled, if you're going to have homeless people there who are sleeping on the benches?
Let's go to
just reality.
Scott is downtown. Hi, Scott. You're calling from downtown. What are your thoughts?
Well, my first thought is that I think why the Curry administration is in such a hurry to tear down the landing, because they don't want to have any competition with Shad Khan's developments that will be built in the shipyards. And I would also say that I think the problem with the landing has been not so much one of permission, but one of finances, in that Sleeman didn't want to put money into improvements. He wanted the city to put money into improvements, and the city wanted him to spend all the money. And so, you know, it's just people who haven't been able to work together. I think if you replace the people, which you can't do with Curry now, you might have a different outcome.
Thanks for that. Lots of emails coming into the show. Here's one from Clyde. Please let Fred Matthews make his points. I didn't realize I was cutting you off, Fred, but Clyde writes, he thinks cronies who are set to make money are the only ones that will stand to benefit from these plans. Here is an email from Lee. Your guests seem to think the root cause of Jax's problems is a dilution of African-American political power. Well, Baltimore and Chicago don't suffer from such a dilution of power, yet they still suffer terribly. And thanks for that feedback, Lee. I don't think that we were saying that the root cause of the city's problems is a dilution of African-American political power, but that that was one of the consequences of consolidation. Yeah. And it's part of a complex interplay of issues that are affecting our politics, our crime rate, a lot of other things well.
And let's give the mayor some credit. You know, we criticize and we make jokes about the whole landing thing, but let's give him credit for the fact that he did recognize that the status quo was not going to prevail in terms of how the landing was. The landing has had a terrible reputation for years. When we opened in 87, we had all the top businesses that you would expect at any mall, and then we start losing them. When you're losing places like Foot Locker and The Gap because they can't afford the rents, you're really having a big problem. Now, one thing people have mentioned is the possibility of turning the landing into an aquarium, and that might be the easiest fix for it, because all we have to do is wait until it floods again, throw in some fish, and we're right there.
And last but not least, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, in this state, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Okay, remember this song?
Oh, yeah.
Only in Florida do police ask for the public's assistance in apprehending a criminal that could have been the star of the music video for Been Caught Stealing by Jane's Addiction. Remember that? This actually happened in real life. A Florida man caught on video hiding stolen baby formula under his dress at a Cape Coral grocery store. He grabbed 28 cans of Enfamil and stuffed them under the long red and purple flowered dress he was wearing. He was also sporting a blue bonnet and white sneakers. Police have dubbed him the Blue Bonnet Baby Formula Bandit.
Ooh. They didn't refuse him service?
Nope.
Would that get up?
If you see him, call the police. And thanks, Fred Matthews, Stephanie Brown, Shelton Hall, and David Bauerlein. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Up next, the 1980s are returning to Forsyth Street for one night only. We'll tell you why in a moment.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance. 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Malignant mesothelioma, Asbestos dust causes this cancer. Learn more from board-certified civil trial specialist Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
There are companies in China that see foreign trademarks they like and they just take them.
These guys almost certainly aren't using the mark. They're sitting around waiting to be bought out.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, trademark squatting. We'll have that story and the rest of the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, a new look at how the brain sees, an explanation of how caricatures became such a popular art form, and the 18th century scientist whose travels convinced him that humans were changing the climate for the worse. It's likely you've never heard of Alexander von Humboldt. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Washington finally gets around to talking about infrastructure. The president gets into a firefight over firefighters. And post Mueller, has the White House asked the attorney general to start asking some questions of his own?
I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, they have not asked me to open an investigation.
It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, you will want to channel your inner Prince or Madonna for Florida Theater's annual benefit. It's a huge party coming up later this month. This year's theme is irresistible. It's 80s on Forsyth. That's right. We are going back to the 80s with Numa Saisalin, president of Florida Theater. Good morning.
Good morning.
And the event committee co-chairs Troy Sperlin of Generation Us and Troy Sperlin Interiors and Missy Peters. She's Community Affairs Manager at Community First Credit Union. Good morning.
Well, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being here, guys. Okay, Numa, last year you transformed the Florida Theater into Studio 54 for an incredible 70s theme party. This year you're going back to the 80s. This is really exciting because I was lucky enough to go to last year's Big Bash, and you completely transformed the Florida Theater. What's it going to be like this time?
I blame Troy and Missy for that, because last year we asked them to co-chair the event, and they went away and talked amongst themselves and came back and said, yes, we will chair your event, but we're not chairing your event because your event is boring.
Oh.
We need an event that people are going to be afraid to miss. And they They did it. This unbelievable party that in 1 year doubled the attendance at our annual benefit. So we're repeating it again this year, Saturday, May 18. We're doing the 80s this year, so it's 80s on Forsyth. All of this benefits the nonprofit Florida Theater, the organization that maintains and programs the historic Florida Theater on Forsyth Street, hence 80s on Forsyth.
Okay, Troy, Missy, I don't know how you're going to top last year's Studio 54 bash, but knowing you two, you will. Everyone's going to have to come with their 80s costumes. You're going to have 80s music, 80s performers. You're going to build a stage over the chairs of the Florida Theater, right?
That's right. The whole first floor becomes party space.
Absolutely. And, you know, think big hair, prom dresses, all of the amazing fashion that took place, or some really bad fashion that took place.
Depending
in the
on
80s.
What you think is good.
And we have tribute artists coming. We have Madonna,
George Michael. And Prince.
That's it.
As well.
Madonna, so. George Michael, and Prince.
And a two-hour dance party. Dance party at the end with the Spasmatics.
Right. Endless cocktails.
Endless cocktails, yes. Yeah.
You're also having Steve Eden and Amadeus, radio personalities, and Eden Kendall also on television. They'll be spinning some music. So
yeah, and we can also catch Melissa Ross, because last year you were a dancing fool.
Oh, it was such a great party.
It was.
And I can't wait, although I have no idea what I'm going to dress up as, but Numa, the idea is to dress 80s style, so people really will outdo themselves.
What Troy has explained to us is you should think about going to the coolest club in the 80s, and you would dress up. So dress like you were going to the best, most fancy pants club in the 80s.
And or not.
Or come as you are. But this is all to support Florida Theater, which is a cultural gem in this community. And
thank you.
So worth supporting.
In 1927, when this theater first opened, there were five other theaters on Forsyth Street already. And this is the only one that survived. So, you know, we're pleased to keep it going. And it's not just, you know, a George Washington slept here house. It's a building and a performance space that we use every night. NDRE opened a tour here the other night. Government Mule is here tonight. Tom Jones is here on Monday. It's a vibrant mm-hmm. place that we continue to keep active.
Great shows all the time. And Missy Community First Credit Union has been wonderful in supporting these cultural happenings and this cultural institution.
Absolutely. You know, we see the Florida Theater as really a historic icon, you know, a place that people will cross the ditch for, will come from Georgia, come from St. Augustine, come from all over the First Coast to attend. And we love, you know, what they stand for. And we love that the fundraising aspect of that, this is going to go to a lot of the historic preservation of the theater.
And not only Community First, but so many other business partners to the theater who have really not only gotten behind this event, but also to contribute to the Florida Theater, not only Dex Imaging, who we have as a mm-hmm. presenting sponsor this year, but also Community First and Redfield Salon, and the list goes on and on.
Absolutely.
So get your tickets now for 80s on Forsyth happening Saturday, May 18th at the Florida Theater. Now, Numa, a minute ago we played a little bit of one of my favorite songs from the 80s, Video Killed the Radio Star from the Buggles. You actually knew them, didn't you, or worked with them?
Jeff Downs, who was in the Buggles, was also a member of Asia, and I worked with them several times.
Asia?
Yes.
You know, this is amazing. There's so much more to you than I realized.
Yeah, and remind
us. With Asia? What the heck is going on here?
Remind us a song from Asia.
Heat of the Moment.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, of course. Who can forget that one?
That one.
Well, in honor of 80s on Forsyth, just for you guys, we are going to close with another iconic song from the 80s, which is also probably the best video MTV ever played, I think. Enjoy this music and get your tickets now for 80s on Forsyth. Numa Cecil and Tori Sperlin, Missy Peters, I'll see you guys there.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
May 18th.
1A's up next. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.